This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, June 5th, 2008. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns. In today's program, a new Senate report reveals further ways the Bush administration misused intelligence leading up to the war in Iraq. Obama stops the Democratic National Committee from taking contributions from lobbyists. And the World Food and Agriculture Organization takes on the issue of rising food prices, but critics say its plan doesn't go far enough to solve the problem. All this and more, but first, these news headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. Military tribunals for five alleged plotters of the September 11th attacks opened today at the Guantanamo Bay Detention Camp and Naval Base. The man thought to be the mastermind behind the attacks, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, will be defending himself in English while facing the death penalty. Four of his co-defendants could also face execution. Mohammed reportedly confessed to being the driving force behind the September 11th attacks after marathon interrogation sessions that included repetitive forced drowning, also known as waterboarding. Evidence obtained through coercion or torture is not admissible in civilian courtrooms, but can be used in military tribunals. Many legal experts regard the hearings that open today as a test balloon for the entire military commission system. In other news, British newspaper The Independent has received leaked details of a deal currently under negotiation in Baghdad that would allow the U.S. military to occupy Iraq indefinitely. The treaty calls for permanent U.S. military bases in Iraq, U.S. control of Iraqi airspace, sweeping powers for U.S. troops to conduct arrest and military actions without consultation, and guaranteed immunity from prosecution for soldiers and contractors. President Bush is reportedly intent on announcing the start of the so-called strategic alliance this summer, meaning the treaty would remain in place regardless of who wins the November presidential election. In India, three left-ruled states today observed a 12-hour shutdown strike to protest major hikes in fuel prices announced yesterday by the Indian central government. Bismila Gilani reports.
The central government's decision to raise fuel prices by at least 10% has provoked strong reactions from across the political spectrum. Both the opposition and the government's left allies have opposed the move. Leftist parties responded with a dawn-to-dusk shutdown in the three states they rule. Normal life in the states of West Bengal, Kerala, and Tripura came to a standstill as the ruling left front enforced the strike. Streets were virtually empty as schools, offices, and businesses remained closed. Activists from the main opposition party, the BJP, held demonstrations in New Delhi and several other parts of the country. The protesters are demanding the government either roll back price hikes or compensate consumers with subsidies and tax cuts. The government, however, says it was left with no alternative in light of soaring international crude oil prices. For FSRN, this is Bismillah Gilani from New Delhi.
Two safety alerts in nuclear power plants in Eastern Europe have reinforced public concerns about nuclear power, but apparently haven't dampened the British government's support for new nuclear facilities. Naomi Fowler reports from London.
The EU's early warning system used in the event of nuclear emergencies was triggered twice in the last 48 hours, with the European Commission notifying all 27 EU states of two separate problems. One was a 35-year-old plant in the Czech Republic where a worker mistakenly turned off coolant pipes. The other was a station in Slovenia where water leaked from the primary coolant unit. While the authorities involved assured citizens that there'd been no radiation discharged, Greenpeace urged EU officials to confirm the incidents were as small as claimed through independent investigation. These incidents will do little to allay public fears about the safety of nuclear power. Its overwhelming unpopularity has so far slowed its growth in Europe. However, Britain and France recently agreed to construct a new generation of nuclear power stations and export the technology around the world. The plan has been criticised for undermining the growth of renewable energy. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has declared the state to be in the midst of its first official drought since 1991. This spring was California's driest in nearly 90 years. One of the primary causes is the shrinking snowpack on the Sierra Mountains, which fills reservoirs during the spring melt. Schwarzenegger is calling for the implementation of a $12 billion bond plan to upgrade California's water management infrastructure. but has stopped short of announcing measures to ration the state's shrinking water supply. And finally, the longest blockade in Canadian history has ended in victory for Indigenous activists over a forestry company. Aaron Lakoff has more from Montreal.
From its headquarters in Montreal, forestry giant Abitibi Bowater made an announcement to the Ontario government on Tuesday that it would stop using wood in an area it refers to as the Whiskey Jack Forest in northern Ontario. The company was clear-cutting on Indigenous land belonging to the Ojibwe Nation, which they refer to as Grassy Narrows. In late 2003, residents of Grassy Narrows set up peaceful road blockades to prevent logging trucks from reaching their community. Roberta Kisik is an Ojibwe resident of Grassy Narrows.
I think it was a big accomplishment on everybody's part, ours and the supporters that we had. However, in terms of the forestry license, when we entered into the treaties, we never gave up our customary laws. The whole thing about this blockade is that we want to take care of the land under our own traditional customary laws.
Kisik maintains that the blockade will stay up until Grassy Narrows is no longer threatened by any logging companies. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Aaron Lakoff reporting from Montreal, Canada.
And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
A new Senate report finds the Bush administration's case for going to war in Iraq contradicted information and intelligence. Two different reports totaling 230 pages lay out numerous examples where the Bush administration publicized to Congress and to the American people false or inaccurate findings. Senator Jay Rockefeller is the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, which authored the report.
It's often been said that truth is the first casualty of war. And today, the Senate Intelligence Committee reports in detail that this was the case in the Bush administration's march to war in Iraq. The tragic fact is that on issues of war and peace, which should require the most meticulous and the most precise adherence to the truth, the administration was too often careless with its words, including, in some cases, making presentations that were not substantiated by the available intelligence, or worse, directly contradicted by the available intelligence. In short, we announced today that a bipartisan majority of the Senate Intelligence Committee, by a vote of 10-5, as was true on the first report on WMD, has found that in making the case for war, the administration did go well beyond what the intelligence community knew and what it believed.
The report found that intelligence did not back up many statements by the administration in the lead-up to the war. For example, it found intelligence did not show a connection between Iraq and al-Qaeda. The report also found the alleged leader of the September 11th attacks, Mohammed Atta, did not meet with Iraqi officials in Prague, that there was no confirmation that Iraq's chemical weapons program continued, and that intelligence warned the U.S. would not be welcomed as liberators. Chair Rockefeller called the Bush administration's handling of the war heinous, but he said he will not endorse criminal prosecution.
It would mean that nothing else, whether it's clean air or whatever, FISA, nothing else would get done. In other words, if you press for that, it's like pressing for impeachment. It's a grand act with only, you know, 5 or 6 months to go. But it's a futile act, and it's a wrong act because we do have business to do. Should it be done in the wide sweep of history? Yes. Should it be done by us now? No.
These findings are the final parts of a 4-year investigation by the Senate panel, a panel that overwhelmingly endorsed the administration's case for war in 2002. Some Republicans on the Senate committee called the findings political and said they were without merit. Even though Senator Clinton has not officially suspended her campaign, something she's expected to do Saturday, the Democratic Party has acknowledged that Barack Obama is the nominee. In a statement, party chair Howard Dean said the time for disagreements had ended and the party must unite. Obama made his first move in becoming the leader of the Democratic Party today. He has banned lobbyist contributions to the Democratic National Committee. Refusing to accept lobbyist donations has been a central platform of his presidential campaign. He has now imposed the rule on the entire Democratic Party. On his first day as the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee, Barack Obama spoke to the Jewish American lobby, attempting to court a constituency he's had trouble appealing to. And during the meeting, Obama seemed to take a more aggressive tone in defense of Israel. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
Earlier in his campaign, Barack Obama had been a more moderate supporter of Israel. But by the time he reached the meeting of the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, he gave convention-goers what they wanted to hear.
As president, I will never compromise when it comes to Israel's security.
He then went on to lay out his steps to do that.
As president, I will implement a memorandum of understanding that provides $30 billion in assistance to Israel over the next decade, investments to Israel's security that will not be tied to any other nation.
Stephen Zunis, chair of Middle East Studies at the University of San Francisco, says Obama's pledge of money is nothing new, but for a candidate who has been generally supportive of Palestinian rights, Obama has left something out.
Obama's promise isn't more than what's being proposed by the Republicans and other Democratic leaders, though it's certainly disappointing to those of us who believe that the Middle East already has too many arms and that U.S. aid to Israel, just like any country, should be conditional on human rights and adherence to international law.
In addition to the aid, Obama noted something that for many has been a sticking point on the road to peace in the region.
Jerusalem will remain the capital of Israel, and it must remain undivided.
Again, Zunis says Obama is leaving out some important information.
He unfortunately did not say what a lot of people were hoping that he would say, is that Jerusalem should also be the capital of an independent Palestinian state, because without the Palestinian populated areas of the city under Palestinian rule, it's unlikely any kind of lasting peace could result.
Zunis says a toughening of Obama's stance is a change from when he first started in politics.
Back then, he seemed to be more allied with the Israeli peace camp and their moderate Palestinian counterparts. Since starting his presidential race, he has moved well to the right and seems to be embracing positions that are more akin to that of the Israeli government.
Obama also stressed that if he were president, he would distinguish himself from his rival John McCain by opening up communication with countries that the U.S. currently does not negotiate with. But Zunis says, again, it's an example of sitting on both sides of the political fence.
He did say that he would refuse these self-defeating preconditions that have hallmarked the Bush administration and what McCain has been advocating. But at the same time, he stressed that he would come in with certain assumptions and demands from the Iranians that it would be at the time and circumstances of his own choosing. It was not the unconditional 1 year that he originally spoke.
In addition to relations with Israel, Obama also stressed strengthening the relationship between African Americans and Jews. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
The World Food and Agriculture Organization's major summit began this week in Rome, Italy. FAO officials were tasked with finding solutions to the rising prices of food worldwide, a situation that's beginning to spark humanitarian crises and unrest in many countries. The use of food crops for biofuels is receiving much of the blame for the shortages. Today is the final day of the summit, and the final declaration of the FAO is out, and it's been greeted by much disappointment, as FSRN's Diletta Varlese reports from Italy.
There are more than 1 billion people throughout the world whose chief concern every day is getting enough to eat. This was one of the first statements made at the UN Food and Agriculture Organization World Meeting in Rome, which ended on Thursday. The meeting was spurred on by the increasing threat of food riots, such as those that erupted in Haiti a month ago. The FAO headquarters in Rome hosted world leaders, as well as UN and EU members and NGOs representatives.
I believe the problem is not the production.
Cristina Kirchner is president of Argentinian Republic.
For small communities, it is a problem of distribution and access to food with sustainable prices.
The themes discussed in the conference included climate change, bioenergy production, GMO foods, agriculture market liberalization, and food sovereignty. Sovereignty is a framework that aims to put local communities and small producers in control of their food and agricultural system. Jacques Duf is FAO's general director. He explains the interconnection of the themes.
We have been saying that for more than a year, that we would be having a crisis on prices because of a combination of factors. First, we have started with very low stocks in the world. That has been also compounded by climate change effects. To that, we should add the increased demand of emerging countries like China, India, Brazil, because their economies are growing. In addition to these factors, we have also seen the demand for bioenergy in the effort to substitute for oil.
The debate over bioenergy crops in South America is growing. At the core of it is the progressive substitution of a variety of food crops for cash crops. Miguel Urioste is president of Fundación Tierra, or Earth Foundation, a land research center in Bolivia.
The problem is the specialization in export cultivation, the so-called agribusiness and monocultivations of commodities such as grain and soy. Those are leading Bolivia to have an unsustainable model of monoproduction of soy that reduces the internal production of traditional foods such as grain and other cereals like quinoa and amaranto.
At the conference, there were representatives of farmers and indigenous organizations from all over the world. The Colombian Tierra Viva, or Land Live, organization works for food sovereignty in local communities. Raúl Collazo Sardila is Tierra Viva spokesperson.
The problem is the specialization in export cultivation, the so-called agribusiness and monocultivations of commodities such as grain and soy. Those are leading Bolivia to have an unsustainable model of monoproduction of soy that reduces the internal production of traditional foods, such as grain and other cereals like quinoa and amaranto.
The plenary session saw an hours-long debate on the most controversial themes, such as biofuel and agricultural market liberalization. The Italian Minister of Foreign Affairs, Franco Frattini, said the meeting was disappointing and less successful than expected. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Diletta Varlese, in Brescia, Italy.
This is Free Speech Radio News. Last week marked the one-year anniversary of the Hugo Chavez government decision not to renew the broadcasting license of Venezuela's most popular television channel, RCTV. The student movement and mass protests that followed was a blow to the popularity of Chavez. It contributed to the December election defeat of a referendum that would have significantly increased the president's power. This year, one prominent veteran of the movement is running for mayor of the largest and poorest section of Caracas. Despite the enthusiasm that has greeted his candidacy, a closer inspection reveals an increasingly fragile and divided opposition movement. Martin Markovitz reports from Caracas.
28-year-old Stalin Gonzalez is not your typical Chavez adversary. Raised in a strict communist household in which he attended socialist gatherings throughout Latin America as a child, he is now challenging Venezuela's socialist president to become the mayor of Libertador, the largest and poorest section of Caracas, and a Chavez stronghold. Stalin is running on a platform emphasizing security in this notoriously violent city and as a fresh face not corrupted by Venezuela's bureaucracy. Although he considers himself a leftist, Gonzalez says that Chavez and his party have politicized leftist ideology.
The things that disturb me the most is that Chavez only works for his political party, and specifically the militant wing, which is even worse. He uses the state channels for his own political purposes and for the interests of his party. And if anyone feels different who doesn't agree with him, he labels them as part of the CIA. I don't think it's very constructive or good for the country.
Stalin Gonzalez is a new face of the opposition student movement, born when the government of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez decided not to renew the broadcasting license for the television network RCTV, Venezuela's oldest and most popular channel. RCTV and especially its soap operas were extremely popular among people in the shantytowns, Chavez's core base. Some political strategists consider RCTV's closure a political miscalculation on Chavez's part, especially after sectors of the barrios aligned with opposition students to massively protest and ultimately defeat a proposed referendum to the Constitution that would have centralized the power of the federal government. The Constitution would have also done away with term limits and given the federal government more direct control of the public universities. The students suddenly became the poster children for what the opposition called freedom of expression. Yosem Rangel is a student at Simón Bolívar University in Caracas, a private university.
The student movement supported RCTV because the majority of Venezuelans cannot just get their information only from the government. You need to get it from all sides, even if you don't agree with it, because when you limit people's access to information, you create an ignorant society.
Chavistas have long claimed that the reason for RCTV's non-renewal was due to it acting as a political entity and because it played a significant role in Chavez's brief removal from power in April of 2002. Carlos Sierra is a student leader at the Central University of Venezuela, a public school.
They misinformed the people. They didn't know what was happening. They were showing cartoons and giving information of the opposition, saying that the government was killing people during the march, which was false. They utilized the means of communication to call Chavez an assassin.
The opposition student movement has brought a fresh face to a deeply war-weary opposition that has repeatedly failed to unseat Chavez for the past 9 years. The students are mostly middle and upper-class kids, mainly from private universities. Chavez supporters say this movement doesn't accurately represent the student population at large, nor do they represent the overall population, of whom more than 70% lives in poverty. Despite student leaders like Stalin Gonzalez who come from leftist and humble origins, a significant portion of the opposition student movement is made up of and controlled by conservative and right-wing forces. Last April, Yon Goicoechea, a student leader, was awarded the Milton Friedman Award from the U.S.-based right-wing think tank, the Cato Institute, in which he received a cash prize of $500,000, fueling fears from Chavez supporters that the opposition students are too close to Washington. Juan Escaloma, an economics professor at the Central University of Venezuela, comments on the significance of Goicoechea's prize.
Milton Friedman was one of the people responsible for policies causing poverty and misery through Latin America. He should not be proud of receiving that award. Friedman worked with Pinochet, which was a very sad chapter in Latin America.
Stalin Gonzalez and other leaders have criticized Goicoechea for accepting the award, but have not distanced themselves from him. However, despite the student movement's role in defeating the Chavez-sponsored referendum, Chavez's popularity still remains strong. According to Caracas-based data analysis, in a recent poll conducted last month, Chavez received a 68% approval rating. Yet the student movement shows no sign of slowing down. Stalin Gonzalez is currently running neck and neck against his Chavez opponent, while Yon Goicoechea says he plans to open a free speech learning center with the $500,000 cash prize he received from the Cato Institute. For FSRN, this is Martin Markovitz in Caracas.
After 25 years of litigation, the U.S. Army and Shell Oil have agreed to pay the state of Colorado more than $35 million for irreversible chemical waste destruction at the Rocky Mountain Arsenal. The U.S. Army and Shell Oil used the land as a chemical manufacturing compound and liquid chemical dump site, which ultimately ravaged the environment and local wildlife. Many say the arsenal is one of the most contaminated sites in the country. The settlement is seen as a major victory for the state, and the money will go towards restoration projects and compensation for local residents affected by the contamination. Blake Wesley is in Denver and files this report.
Just a few miles northeast of Denver sits a 27-square-mile block of land known as the Rocky Mountain Arsenal. Throughout the Cold War, the site was used by the U.S. Army to manufacture chemical weapons of mass destruction, such as napalm and nerve gas. Shell also leased portions of the land to manufacture industrial and agricultural chemicals. But Colorado Attorney General John Southers says the Army and Shell are responsible for creating one of the largest hazardous waste sites in the nation.
Manufacturing waste from both the Army and Shell were transported through chemical sewers to on-site disposal basins, which unfortunately did not have adequate seals for their environmental containment. The result was significant soil, surface water, and groundwater contamination, and considerable injury to wildlife due to chemical exposure.
To this day, visitors are barred from setting foot on the site. The Department of Public Health and the Environment continues to monitor birth defects and cancer rates of residents in nearby communities. But cleanup manager for the Department of Public Health and the Environment, Jeff Edson, says the local wildlife has been hardest hit by the contamination.
During the time that the arsenal was active, there were weeks or months where they would pull hundreds of dead birds out of certain areas out there that came in contact with surface water.
With the contamination found in groundwater, ditches, streams, lake beds, and in the air, director of the Colorado Department for Public Health and the Environment, Jim Martin, says it continues to be a major cleanup operation.
It's a massive undertaking out there. The pollution, it was one of the most contaminated sites in the country, if not the world. The Army and Shell have spent literally $2.1 billion, billion with a B, trying to clean up the environmental damage that was then out there. And in the middle of that, we were also trying to assess the natural resources damages, the kinds of damages that you can't replace or you can never bring back.
It's the natural resource damages the Army and Shell were reluctant to pay for and kept the litigation in stagnation for nearly three decades. But according to U.S. Senator of Colorado Ken Salazar, the state spent over $2 million on scientific assessments to determine the extent of natural resource damages.
Damage to soil, water, birds, wildlife, and you have to quantify what the amount of damage would be. So that's those are the types of damages that we're dealing with here. So although this case was filed 25 years ago, there has already been, as it was mentioned, $2.1 billion in remedial activities. And at this point, now you start into the natural resource damages part of the case, which could have gone for another 15 or 20 years. But the way that it was brought to a close makes a lot of sense.
Colorado Attorney General John Southers argues that outgoing Shell President John Hoffmeister was a significant force behind resolving the settlement.
In my opinion, Mr. Hoffmeister brought a significant focus over the last year to the process of bringing this matter to resolution after all these years.
Hoffmeister claims the settlement represents a new chapter for Shell's commitment to energy and environmental stewardship.
For Shell, this is the ending of one chapter and the beginning of a new chapter. This chapter that we're opening today, and preserving in particular the Northeast Greenway Corridor, will stand the testimony and give witness to the great work that has gone on behind the scenes to make sure that the lessons learned will be repeated in the future.
While Hoffmeister is ready to turn the page, Salazar says resolving the litigation dispute with Shell and the Army is just the beginning. There's still more work to be done.
I think for natural resource damages, there's a lot more that has to be done to restore the South Platte River and Sand Creek and the whole Greenway.
Because of the extreme chemical contamination to the environment, Salazar says the $35 million settlement is only a starting point towards developing long-term environmental restoration. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Blake Wesley.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. For Monica Lopez, Kristen Schwartz, Shannon Young, Leanne Caldwell, Oscar Hernandez, and Rose Khadabshi, I'm Jess Burns in Eugene, Oregon.